Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, Managing Editor of News at WCAI, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Sean.
Joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Jim DeRuda is calling in from the New Bedford Standard Times. We'll hear from Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's start with Pilgrim, George. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station last night was a meeting between federal regulators, local officials, and the owners of that power station. Lots happening this week with that nuclear power plant.
That's right. This meeting last night had to do with Pilgrim being rated as one of the 9 worst performers in the country. Not good news for those folks living close to the plant. It got this downgrade, so to speak, because of its unplanned and forced shutdowns during the last year. Many of these involved some complications, and the NRC has expressed some concerns about it. A lot of people have gotten very vocal about this. We were talking off air before, and a lot of these people have been around for years and years fighting this plant. Mary Lambert out of Duxbury, Pine Dubois out of Kingston, and some of the folks here on Cape Cod in the Downwinders group have been fighting to get more scrutiny of this plant. And it appears that the NRC is about to do that. One of the people there last night had an interesting quote. He said, "The integrity of Pilgrim's containment matches the integrity of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission." He said it's lacking. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is how people are feeling at this point. But it does appear that their Pilgrim is about to undergo some more scrutiny in the coming year.
A lot of the concern about Pilgrim has to do with the spent fuel rods, which are stored in a pool above the main reactor, below the roof of the reactor building. And because Yucca Mountain, which is the location where the country thought all the nuclear spent fuel would be located, that is not going to happen. So there is no Yucca Mountain. So now reactors like Pilgrim, they're taking those fuel rods, they're going to put them in these storage containers. Right.
It's called dry cask storage. And one of the concerns here is, of course, Pilgrim is right on the water in Manomet in Plymouth. And one of the real concerns is sea level rise and climate change. And, you know, so could we face a risk where suddenly, you know, water is getting into these dry cask storage and suddenly we have contamination in the water. People are trying to raise these concerns now so that it's thought about before, you know, any kind of move is made to take these spent fuel rods out of the system that they're in now and moved into these dry cask systems. So it's not just the plant's performance now, it's what's going to happen in the future. As we know, this spent fuel is going to be around for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And I think there was also some reporting earlier in the week regarding whether the reactor would be susceptible to problems from earthquakes.
That's right. You know, we don't think about earthquakes here, but apparently, you know, earthquakes can be felt as far as 400 miles away. And so there is some concern by the NRC that whether the structure at Pilgrim can sustain the seismic tremors that are caused by earthquakes, and they're going to do some sort of a study to see if Pilgrim can sustain it.
A lot of momentum on this issue, a lot of people involved, a lot of different points of view, and so I'm sure we'll continue to cover it as we have for the past few years. As you say, those unplanned shutdowns were very concerning. A lot of times they seem to be related to mechanics, and it was difficult to even figure out at the time why certain things were happening.
I don't know if you wanted to mention this as well, but there was a drill at the plant earlier
this
week as well, which we covered, and that particular drill had to do with whether the plant is susceptible to a terror attack and how the response would be to such an attack. And so they went through the drill, and it'll be graded by the NRC to see how the plant reacted, as well as the emergency response teams around the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. I guess a key bit of information here is Cape Cod was not included in any of this because we're outside the 10-mile radius for this plant. So even though there will be some impact because we're downwind from the plant, should there be any nuclear release from this plant, the emergency personnel here on Cape Cod were not part of this drill.
There's no plan for the Cape.
No.
And that's been reported quite a bit. And, of course, people who oppose the plan, that's one of their top reasons. The NRC came in to speak with the editorial board of the Cape Cod Times this week. Did they address any of these things, particularly that evacuation zone or a planning zone?
Not to my knowledge, but that's where that story was generated about what's happening with the earthquake study.
I see. Let's talk about what I like to call the tourist train, which began last year, bringing folks down to the Cape on the weekends. Tell us about the train, and it looks like it's going to happen again.
Right. Well, this was heralded as a big success last year, and they're hoping to build on that in the coming year. Interesting note, I thought, was that they're actually doing some marketing over in Europe, you know, letting folks know who are maybe planning a visit to the Boston area or to the Cape Cod area. Look, if you come here, you come to Boston, you can get to Cape Cod by train.
And then what do?
You go to the beach.
Oh,
there's nothing else to do.
Walk to the beach.
Well, you know, my understanding is that they do have some bus service available, mm-hmm. you know, when visitors come in to certain key locations. So you're not just stranded in Hyannis.
Oh, good.
You can move along.
Okay.
And I'm sure, you know, there's car rental and things like that.
Sure, of course.
One of the things they've also tried to do is cut the price in half for seniors and people with disabilities. So they're looking to help out those folks as well to get here. And as I said, you know, they're really applauding the success of this. I think it surprised even the people who thought it would be a good idea just how much ridership they got. Last year they did it from Memorial Day through Columbus Day.
Yeah.
And initially they were only going to do it through Labor Day, but it was so successful that they expanded it through Columbus Day.
It actually made money, if I remember correctly.
It made money, and I think it's somewhere to the tune of $300,000, something like that. You know, one other thing, there's going to be a new stop this year, you know, for folks who may or may not want to go to Wareham. Is going to be one of the stops.
And so it comes down from Boston, and it goes through all the way through Middleborough?
It goes through Middleborough, yes. So it's not maybe the way you would go from Boston to Cape Cod. I think it's about a two-hour train ride.
So, from South Station, right?
From South Station. So, but it's better than what you're going to do sitting in traffic on a Friday afternoon.
Does it stop in Buzzards Bay?
It does stop in Buzzards Bay as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's an area that could use some more people and coming in and out Buzzards Bay.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about this plan. Orleans, East Ham, and Chatham, I understand, kind of getting together to deal with this piping plover issue. Mm. You know, these little birds, they come here and they nest, and some people want to find a way around them, I guess.
You say plover, I say plover.
Right.
I'm not sure which one is.
I've been assured by Vern Locks, our resident ornithologist, that either is correct.
Okay.
Yeah,
so thank you, Vern, for that. I appreciate that. But it's one of those things where, you know, it's affecting Cape beaches all up and down the coast. You know, it's not just these towns. Then they're all trying to find some sort of a solution to coexist. People want to use the beaches. They want to use the beaches with their cars, and that's what was happening down in Orleans. And they were very close to finding a solution where there would be these guided escorts out to the beach, either on the ground, people walking the cars out, or actually another car going out with them, showing them, look, you got to avoid this area, you got to avoid that area. But the plan is pretty complicated. And they're not sure they're going to get it in place by July 15th, which is about the time the birds arrive. So, and even if they did, at this point, they still have to train all their staff. So the idea is, let's get the plan in place and implement it next year. So I think that's why they put the brakes on this right now.
So a lot of this has to do with like Jeeps and these off-road vehicles that want to be able to access the beach and use the dune buggies and
four-wheel drive vehicles.
Right. So the towns, they're selling permits to go out there and do it. And then these people who purchase the permits find out, wait, I can't use this.
Right. And they're not cheap. I mean, they're over $100 in most places to get one of these permits to go out on the beach, and then you can't use it. So they have frustrated consumers, and the officials themselves get frustrated. An interesting side note on this, one of the things that environmental regulators want on this is they want some sort of a plan to protect the plovers against predators. But the Beach Buggy Association, which is helping town officials come up with this plan, saying, we don't want to kill another bird, say a crow or something, to protect a plover.
Oh, yes.
You know, so there's that disconnect as well. So all these things are going to be worked out over the next year, and hopefully they can put some sort of a plan in place for the following season.
It can get really controversial. We've seen that in other areas of the state, too. I think it was up in Ipswich. I think the Cape Cod Times did a story a few years ago where they were shooting coyotes in order to protect the eggs of the birds, and people didn't go for that so much, one species over the other. It's a difficult issue to deal with.
It's funny that as people, we make these decisions over which ones are more important.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. When we discuss the top news stories of the week, I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. So Harwich Town Meeting is coming up on Monday. Any big items or issues that you're paying close attention to?
Indeed. The first big thing is the warrant, which is 75 articles long.
Whoa.
Quite significant. And there's also a 12-article special town meeting to begin on Tuesday. So Harwich voters should sort of prepare themselves for the long haul here.
Use the bathroom
first. We're looking forward to include two articles that are related to the improvements proposed for Route 124, a pretty controversial topic in town. One article is a petition sponsored by residents of the road, which seeks to appropriate just enough town funds to make needed repairs along that highway, drainage and things like that. A second article that was sponsored by Selectmen was seeking the funding to do the complete project as proposed by the town's engineers and sanctioned by the state. Which is something residents don't want. They feel that's too big of an improvement for the roadway. That article, however, won't be moved. Selectmen have decided to postpone the decision on how much improvements will be made so they can continue to work with the engineers on waivers from state requirements. So it'll be interesting to see if the residents approve the petition article, which could put a little ding in the selectmen's plans. A couple other major articles. There's a couple important beach access issues to be addressed at the meeting. One is a petition article in the special town meeting, which is a resolution proposed by the Friends of Bayview Beach, who want the town to support their efforts to fight a claim by beachfront owners to ownership of the beach down there at Bayview Beach. There's a 6-foot right-of-way that exists, but the shorefront owners are claiming that they own the entire beach due to accretion that's occurred over the years, and that issue is now before the land court. Further down the beach, the selectmen have signed an agreement giving up a portion of Bank Street Beach to resolve a boundary dispute with a abutter down there and correct a 1985 taking, and that agreement has to be approved by town meeting. A couple other major land acquisition articles. Town meeting will be asked to spend $220,000 to buy two parcels of open space near Island Pond in conjunction with the Harwich Conservation Trust. And voters will also be asked to shell out $825,000 for 2.2 acres known as the Downey property adjacent to Sackwatucket Harbor. And officials have really had their eye on that property for some time to expand parking and other facilities at that harbor. All this and more is on tap for that meeting, which gets underway Monday at 7 p.m. at the Community Center on Oak Street.
Okay, and I understand the Cape Cod Chronicle has an update on the story about the gentleman who, on Super Bowl Sunday, decided to take the bobcat into the wetlands?
Indeed, David Rogers, who's become somewhat notorious locally for that escapade where he scraped salt marsh off the beach at his Sears Point home, he was fined a week or so ago by an Orleans court magistrate, $33,000 for violations related to that incident. It's considerably less than the $126,000 worth of tickets that the Conservation Commission had issued, but it's still probably the largest fine for a wetlands violation ever in Chatham. The magistrate found Rogers responsible for 11 daily citations between February 3rd and 12th, which was when he filed a restoration plan for that shoreline. And officials are still negotiating over that restoration plan now, which involves replanting the salt marsh, seeding the area with shellfish. They hope to finalize the plan in a couple weeks. One thing that's clear is that a little escapade is going to be end up being pretty costly for Mr. Rogers, not only does he have $33,000 in fines, but according to some of our sources, the cost of this restoration plan is in the low six figures. So his little jaunt onto the shoreline Super Bowl Sunday is going to cost him pretty dearly.
Have we heard from him? Any idea whether he'll appeal this or go forward? Last I think we spoke about it, he was pretty conciliatory with the
town. He was. And I talked to his attorney the other day who said that they're reserving their right to appeal pending the final outcome of the restoration plan. There's a couple issues that they're still negotiating over. One of which is shellfish, how much shellfish should be restored out there. If the plan comes to their satisfaction, then they won't appeal. But they are certainly reserving their rights at this time until they see the final order from the Conservation Commission.
One more story that you alerted me to. I didn't have an opportunity to read it, but I'm interested in it. The Ms. Eelgrass contest is coming back.
Indeed, this is a pretty notorious event for Chatham. It began about 30 years ago when a group of fishermen and parents got together to try to raise some money for local kids organizations. They enlisted some women to dress up in outlandish costumes and take on names like Tina Tuna and Scallop O'Hara to vie to become the mate of Captain Eelgrass, who is also known as Fisherman Paul Lucas. It's kind of a faux beauty contest. It was held for 10 years at the Chatham VFW. It was a big success, very local event, and the Chatham Merchants Association has decided to bring it back. It's going to be held August 30th over Labor Day weekend back at the VFW here in town as sort of a cap to the summer. And they've been able to enlist a lot of the original participants from 30 years ago, including Captain Eelgrass himself, and I hope some of the original contestants. And there'll be raffles and silent auctions and enough inside jokes to keep Chatham residents buzzing for the fall and winter, I'm sure.
Wow, I love it. That is above the fold news there come August. Tim Wood, thanks very much. We appreciate it. Tim is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thanks, Tim. And let's see, Josh Balling is on the phone, of course. Joshua Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. Welcome back to The Point, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. There's some controversy on Nantucket regarding a turf playing field.
There is. It's a turf field at the Nobodier Farm Road playing field complex, which has a number of playing fields, both mostly grass, but there is a turf field that is being installed. And apparently it has the wrong lines on it. It was designed and intended for adult soccer, youth soccer, and adult lacrosse, but it has been purchased and is being installed with only adult soccer, men's lacrosse, and women's lacrosse lines. And it was originally intended just for mostly for youth sports, youth soccer in particular, and it's really outlining what appears to be a breakdown in communication between some town officials, members of the Community Preservation Committee, which funded a large portion of the field, as well as town administration and members of the Park and Recreation Commission. We're talking about about a $450,000 turf field project here, and town officials are trying to sort out what exactly happened, how it got ordered with the wrong lines on it, and who is going to end up paying for the right lines to be put on or repainted each time the field has to change in use. A lot of angst going into this. Playing fields a fairly big deal out here on Nantucket. We have a lot of youth sports, a lot of recreational sports, and not that much land for sporting activities. We have a lot of open space, but most of it is protected for walking and viewing, but not so much active recreation, formal competitive sports.
So relining, that's expensive, or it takes a lot of time? It's not
very
just chalk?
It's being installed right now, so it's unlikely that a new turf field could be installed. We have a very cool video on our website that actually shows them putting the field in. There's a lot of prep work that goes in, and then they actually sew the field together and then stake it, spike it down, and that's how it sits on the ground. So it's unlikely that a new field would be purchased and installed, and then so the lines would have to be figured out and either put on after the fact or repainted with some kind of removable, you know, reusable, some kind of paint that would, you know, be good enough for the playing, but then could be removed and repainted for the next use, whether it was a different sport or the lines are different for youth and adult soccer, different, slightly different places. So middle of the discussion right now, and it'll be interesting to see exactly how this plays out before the summer when some of these sports really start getting going.
I getcha. Okay. And there are two movies being shot on island right now, right?
There are. That's the other big news. We have two feature films being shot on Nantucket, one an independent film and one a Hollywood production. The independent film is being done by Jay Craven, an independent filmmaker who is also a college professor up in Vermont. He's a known face on Nantucket. He's been coming down here for a while doing a number of different things, primarily with the library, the Athenaeum, and also with the Nantucket Film Festival. He ran the Teen View program for the film festival for a couple years, and he and his crew are filming Peter and John, which is based on a Guy de Maupassant novel set in 1870s Nantucket. He's filming for the next 2 weeks or so, and been all around town. It's a period piece. Actors in costume have been seen various locations around downtown, horse-drawn carriages. And John Shea, who's a lifelong actor, director, writer of stage and screen, has been in a number of movies on Broadway as well, some TV shows. And he's called Nantucket home for about 40 years. And he has brought some Hollywood star power to the island with his film Gray Lady, which isn't the high-profile Nantucket resort destination most people think of as the set. It's sort of more of the gritty off-season Nantucket he's using as the backdrop for this thriller, sort of a detective film, and it's in the process of filming right now. They're out and about too, so if you see some movie cameras and see some actors out and about, that's what's going on here on Nantucket.
Okay, if folks want to see that video of the turf playing field being installed or learn more about the shooting of these films or the upcoming or the gearing up of the season on Nantucket, they should go to the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror website. And of course, Josh Balling is the assistant editor of the paper and director of digital content at the paper. You can follow Josh on Twitter at JBallingIM. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Okay. On the phone, Jim DeRuda. He's the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Welcome to The Point, Jim.
Thank you, Sean. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about New Bedford's smoking ban in public parks.
Well, New Bedford is trying to enforce through its health board a ban of smoking in public places. Their law says periodic unannounced inspections of a workplace, public place, membership association, or food establishment includes the public parks.
Hmm. Okay. Is that controversial?
You know, you'd think it would be. 70% of the city is non-smokers, but they're pretty open-minded. A lot of the non-smokers say, well, smokers need some place to smoke, but if I go to the park, I'm going there for fresh air.
Right.
Makes me wonder, though, that smokers are going there for fresh air, too, even if they're having a cigarette.
Yeah, the smoking lobby is getting smaller and smaller. So, okay. And so where does that stand? What's happening with that now?
Well, they're not writing tickets. They're just trying to sort of warn people and say, you know, there's no smoking allowed here. And The health department's looking around when they're out there and talking to people, but they're also counting on peer pressure and folks in the park, non-smokers, to look and say, you know, you shouldn't be smoking out here right now. There's a law against it.
Right. Oh, I like. Okay. Regulation enforcement. We can just scowl at people and they'll stop doing what. Let's talk about New Bedford has a new poet laureate.
Yes. Patricia Gomes, who's been a poet for more than 20 years, she's one of the co-founders of the Greater New Bedford Writers Block Group. She was chosen by the New Bedford Cultural Council from a list of seven candidates, and she is now the official poet laureate for New Bedford.
What does that involve? What does she have to do with?
Well, part of her duties is to engage students in New Bedford. The announcement was made in the Renaissance Community School for the Arts, which is New Bedford's first innovation school, one of the schools that has all kinds of autonomies, and it's focused on the arts. It just began this September. And she was in there in a class of second graders with the mayor for the announcement, and that's part of what she's going to do, is go to schools and engage children to help them appreciate the arts, not just the kids in the Renaissance school.
Oh, that's a wonderful thing. Yeah, I want to bring up last week, I wasn't here, I was on vacation, but Mindy Todd was the host of the Point last week, and you were on with her. You talked about the deployment of Narcan in New Bedford to police and fire personnel. I guess there was some training for that. And then on Saturday, that training occurred, right? And you were telling me about one particular officer who was trained?
Yes, a female officer who was trained Saturday morning. Before the day was over, she was called to an apartment where a man was found with a hypodermic needle beside him, and he was unconscious. Fire department responded too, and between the police and fire, they pulled this man back from the brink of death, from an overdose.
Just a few hours after they learned how to actually do that.
Yes. And statewide, they say that this police and fire program, which is new, it's only in six communities in Massachusetts so far, but it's already responsible for 400 overdose reversals. And I received a phone call in my office on Wednesday, from a man who found his own daughter in the bathroom next to a hypodermic needle and passed out, and he saw her revived before his eyes by the police and fire.
Wow, this heroin problem is not getting any better. Jim DeRuda is the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And you can follow the editorial page of the New Bedford Standard Times on Twitter at OpinionSCT. Of course, that SCT stands for South Coast Today. And let's go to Sally Rose. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. She joins us on the phone. Hello, Sally.
Hello, Sean.
So the selectmen are taking a look around town and saying, hey, what do we got for surplus here? What can we do with it?
Well, right. And there are a couple buildings that were on the market and received some bids. And just this week, early this week, the Provincetown Board of Selectmen decided to go ahead and sell one of them, that being the Grace Gouveia building. That's the one that's been home to the DPW and Council on Aging for many years. Mm-hmm. And they're selling that to a condominium developer for $710,000. Now, that was despite a 90-signature petition and then a variety of speeches from many residents, who asked them to hold off until the new Board of Selectmen is in place. And, Sean, that's going to be in less than a week. The election in Provincetown is this Tuesday, May 6th. And with that election, the board will have three new members. So most of the residents who signed the petition, they wanted the whole building to be affordable housing. This developer is proposing a total of 9 condominiums, 3 of which will be affordable. And it's just a reminder, it's New Boston Ventures. And they originally offered the town just over $1 million for the 8,500-square-foot building. And the principal of that negotiated the price down more recently, offering to build the deed restriction in for the 3 affordable units into the price of the sale. So the town agreed and cut the selling price by 115,000 per affordable unit. So that's a total of 345,000. And then they added a further restriction that requires the buyer to name the building Grace Gouveia for the next 200 years.
Oh. What's that about?
Well, that was the building was named that for many years, and it was tribute to a woman in town who was a teacher and did a lot of lovely work throughout.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah,
that's nice they thought of her.
Yeah, yes, as all part of it. And then, interestingly, the other surplus building that was the former community center. Also this week, there's news on that, and that was essentially withdrawn or rejected, depending on how you look at it. That had a $550,000 bid, and it was it's a 9,200 square foot building, and that's the bid was about half its market value. So, but the proponent said he was unable to get financing for the project if it included a deed restriction, and the selectman said they'd go into negotiations for that building at that price because they liked his proposal for which was for a 49-bed dormitory style housing for seasonal employees. In addition to, he was going to use it as some storage for his bike company. So, but they wanted to put those deed restrictions in, and he said that he just couldn't get the financing for it.
Hmm. So okay. Well, the election's coming up next week, you say?
That's right.
Okay, we'll talk to you about it next Friday, find out what happened. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner, and we appreciate you joining us, Sally. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
George Brennan is here in the Woods Hole studio with me at WCAI. He, of course, is with the Cape Cod Times. He's a reporter there. Speaking of elections, George, there was a story in the paper, I think it was on Sunday, about how some communities are taking a look at how they handle their municipal elections and saying, hey, maybe we can't use the schools anymore. We got to keep these buildings secure, right?
That's right. There will be a few voters going to new locations this year, including here in Falmouth, where many voters will now be voting at the high school. I know we just talked about not using schools, but they're not going to use three elementary schools as a result of that here in Falmouth. The Morse Pond School, the T-Ticket School, and the East Falmouth School will no longer be used. And the concern was when voters come into those particular buildings, they weren't coming into a separate separate entrance. They were coming in the main entrance.
Yeah.
And in some of the schools, they had to actually go through the hallways, and they could be in there with students passing and faculty. And, you know, there is a lot of concern now about safety in schools and limiting access to the public to the schools during the school day because of some of the incidents we've had across the country. You don't know who's coming in, and could someone use that as an opportunity? In Sandwich, what they've done in a couple of the schools, and that election will be next week, next Thursday, is they've moved to a separate location. A separate entrance.
Oh.
And within the schools. So voters will be going into the gym without having to go through the main entrance in those particular schools. So they've worked it out there. I didn't realize what an issue this was, you know, across the Cape, but across the country. Increasingly, schools are saying it's just not working out with our safety plans to have voters coming in, even though these public buildings are probably the most accessible to disabled people. They have the space. Many of them have gymnasiums or cafeterias where voting can be set up. And in some cases, like in Mashpee, I guess what they've done is they've moved the town election to a weekend so it doesn't interfere.
Uh-huh.
And they hold it in a school there.
Right.
And when there's a big election, like a gubernatorial election or a presidential election, they actually close down the school for the day.
Oh.
So that voters aren't in the school at the same time as students.
And this could end up costing communities money because they might actually have to lease space. If you can't use your schools, maybe your other municipal buildings might not actually lend themselves to this type of access.
That actually happened in Yarmouth. One of their three buildings that they used was a school. And in that case, It's kind of an interesting story. The last time they used it as a voting facility, someone rode a bike down the hallway during the school day, and the Yarmouth police said, look, we have to do something about this. we have to make a change here. And Yarmouth is now leasing space in a realtor building that's big enough to house them, but it does cost them a little money as a result.
Right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Nelson Siegelman. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. We're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan of the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone, Nelson Siegelman, editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. High school principal has resigned.
Yes, Steve Nixon resigned. He initially took a leave of absence for medical reasons. That was the initial announcement, and then that was followed by the announcement that he would offer his resignation to the school committee, and that would take effect essentially at the end of the school year. But he will not be in school for the next several weeks while they make the transition. And they've tapped the assistant superintendent to take over for him. So it's a big change.
Has that assistant superintendent been a principal before?
Yes, he has. He has quite a background, so we don't expect that to really be an issue. And there are two co-principals at the high school. Both of them have experience. So it's not expected really to disrupt the school. It's just always a surprise when someone that's been there for a while leaves. And obviously when they take a leave for medical reasons, you have a concern for the person that they, certainly will
right.
regain their health. And Steve Nixon's been the principal since February 2008. So he's been there for a while. And prior to that, he was a teacher. So the school will move on. It's quite resilient that way.
There's a very interesting story in the Martha's Vineyard Times this week, and I encourage people to go to the website to read it. But maybe you can give us the highlights, Nelson. A gentleman had some electronics stolen in Boston, and that led to a whole series of events to get that stuff back.
Yes, I love this story. It was great fun writing it and just hearing the whole thing because it illustrated so many different parts. One, police work. Two, just the nature of policing on Martha's Vineyard, which is really very personal. You know, people know the police here, or even if they don't, the police tend to try and do their best to help out the people who live here. So an electrical contractor who'd been up in Boston to see a Red Sox play, he stayed at a friend's house overnight. When he left the next morning to catch a very early ferry home, halfway through his trip, he realized that a bag that had contained his iPad and his Apple computer and his company checks was missing from the trunk. And when he arrived at his office at 8 in the morning, he called the Quincy police and asked and said, look, I'm tracking my iPad. He had one of these Find My iPhone apps on it, and he could see that his iPad was located somewhere in Dorchester, and he called the Quincy police thinking they'd spring into action because he could tell them exactly where it was, and they told him, well, we can't do anything till you file a report. So you can imagine how frustrated he was, and being on Martha's Vineyard, so he called a Oak Bluff police officer that he knows and thought, well, maybe he can intercede and get the Quincy police to get out of their chairs and start doing something before he could get up to Quincy and file a report. And the Oak Bluff police officer didn't know anyone in Quincy, but he knew that the Edgartown police had contacts with the Boston gang unit, so he called Detective Mike Snowden, who called his contact at the Boston gang unit, and he said, well, sure, we can help. And he sent two men in a car over to where the iPad seemed to be located, and they were in contact on the phone, sort of watching this thing move around Dorchester, and finally the police had seen the same fellow in three different locations, and they arrested him, and they recovered the iPad and the computer and all the checks. And then just by happenstance, the Edgartown police were going up on Saturday to see the Boston Bruins play, and they were meeting some of the Boston police officers, so the Boston police officers brought all the equipment to them. Mm. And on Monday morning, the Edgartown police were able to return all of the equipment. So it had quite, as one of the Lieutenant Tim Williamson from the Oak Bluffs Police told me, he said, it doesn't always work out this way, but when it does, it's a beautiful thing.
Well, you did a good job encapsulating it there, but it's a nice narrative. So I encourage folks, again, to go to the Martha's Vineyard Times to read it. I know you're only reading about an iPad. Maybe it doesn't seem that significant, but all the interactions that you were kind of laying out there were very interesting, and it's good that this gentleman was able to get that.
Yeah, it's nice when the good guys win one, isn't it?
I know. Okay, Nelson Sigelman is the editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you very much, Nelson.
You're welcome.
And, of course, with me in the Woods Hole studio is George Brennan from the Cape Cod Times. George, story in Mashpee, free preschool in that town. That's not common. That's kind of new.
Not only is that not common, but it's not even common. I mean, towns don't even have to offer kindergarten for free.
Full day, yeah.
Full day. So the fact that Mashpee is offering preschool is a big deal. And they're offering it to every four-year-old in town this coming fall. This is an initiative by Superintendent Brian Hyde, who says, you know, look, this is a way to get kids ready for school. When they get to kindergarten these days, it's no longer just playing with blocks. They're doing English, they're doing math,
yep.
And they're getting to work. And so it's really important to get kids started. I mean, for years, we've talked about things like Head Start and the significance of those programs and getting kids ready to meet the challenges that will face them in education. And so this initiative is going to cost about $60,000 in transportation, and it's being heralded by not only local people, but it's also state officials are saying, you know, this is a good program, and also some of the people who do child development across the Cape are eager to see how this works. Quite a bold initiative, and I'm sure we'll check back to see how it works.
Sure, you got to see how many people are going to take advantage of it.
Right. There are issues, of course. You know, it's not a full day program, so it causes some issues with childcare for working parents, just as kindergarten does. You know, the half day programs there often cause, issues with how do you balance that. But there will be transportation.
There is transportation. Whether parents want to put the kids that young onto a school bus, I don't know.
Right.
But we'll have to see how it works, as you say. Cape Wind. Let's talk about Cape Wind. Of course, we've been talking about the different lawsuits that have been filed in opposition to Cape Wind. That's been one of the reasons it's taken more than a decade, perhaps. There are other issues, of course, that are part of that as well. But a judge was talking about lawsuit around how much the power would cost if these turbines actually go up in Nantucket Sound. 130 turbines in Nantucket Sound are planned.
That's right. This has to do with the agreement that was reached between the utilities and Cape Wind. And the interesting thing here is that, you know, the state was the one to facilitate this. And so this is in this lawsuit is in U.S. District Court. And the 11th Amendment to the Constitution does not provide – a state has to agree to be party to a lawsuit. A sovereign, so to speak, has to agree to it. And what state is going to agree to be sued?
Right.
How you get beyond that. So it's sort of this complicated, legal I can't think of a word for it, but it comes up in the various federal lawsuits that have been initiated between the tribes and the state when it comes to casinos. The tribes are sovereign, the state's sovereign. You know, can they sue one another?
Yes.
And it's kind of a complicated issue.
It sounds like the judge here really thought these complications could get in the way.
Well, he's saying right off the bat, I don't know how we get beyond this.
Yeah.
And so now it's going to be up to both sides, or in this particular case, the people who are advocating for this suit to go forward, the opponents of Cape Wind, to show the judge why they can sue the state in federal court. So they have to get beyond that first in order for this to go forward.
Okay, let's talk about Joseph Vaudo, I think the last name is. He's the owner of the Joe's Lobster Mart in Sandwich, and he got caught up in this whole receiving stolen property thing regarding shellfish.
That's right. This goes back to that last summer when oyster beds were being robbed in Dennis and Barnstable, an individual who's believed to be responsible for that, suspected of that, is going to be arraigned in the coming week in Barnstable Superior Court. But Vado's role was allegedly that he accepted some of this stolen oysters, and the state stepped in, the State Department of Public Health, and said, "We're going to revoke your license." As a result, they filed a notice of intent a couple of weeks ago that triggered a 14-day appeal where Vado could say, "Look, I want to appeal this," and he did do that within the 14 days. So that's currently pending. It hasn't, as of the writing of this, the state agency that will hear the appeal hadn't received it yet, but I did receive word yesterday that they now are in possession of this case, and no date's been set. In the interim, he can remain open for business, and he is open for business on the Cape Cod Canal.
And of course, Vado, who's 69, pleaded guilty in March to receiving
That's correct.
Cape Cod Museum of Art, we've been watching there as they've been looking for a new director. They've had some issues over the years, but new director now. Who's that?
They're very excited about this. It's Edith D.D. Tonelli, and she's a Chinese brush painter from West Barnstable. They said they did a nationwide search, but believed that this local person was had the ideal qualifications for what they were looking for here. As you said, the museum did go through a tough period a few years back where they had $400,000 in debt. Things were looking pretty bleak. But the two directors that they've had since then have helped the museum rebound. The debt has been wiped away, and people are feeling very excited about not only this new director, but getting out from under some of the debt that they did have.
It's a gem of a museum, and they do a lot of exhibits with local artists, and you know, we have so many.
Well, one thing you can say about Cape Cod is we're blessed with some tremendous artists here on the Cape.
Yeah, and they have an archive there as well, and there's a lot to be archived in this particular place, of course. Just a couple minutes left here. The longtime director of the Yarmouth DPW passed away. A lot of people are saddened by that. He was very active in that rail trail extension, just all around considered a very good guy.
You know, Patrick Cassidy wrote this story. I've written stories like this over the years, and when you read them, it's like, why didn't I ever meet this guy?
Yeah,
you know,
right. Yes.
He sounds like such an everyday guy, mm-hmm. But also a presence in town. Someone who was sort of a Mr. Fix-It. His family describes him as their personal MacGyver. For people who don't know, MacGyver was the guy who could make something out of nothing, and so he worked for the town as the director since 1993, and that's when he moved to the Cape. And, you know, sadly, he's only 66 years old. He had been looking forward to retirement soon, but was going to stay here on the Cape, even though he came from off Cape, from Rhode Island. This is a place that he grew to love, and as many people do, you know, when they come here, many of us are wash ashores, myself included, and you come to this place, and it becomes a place that becomes your home. You know, so family and friends are feeling like he was robbed a bit here. But, you know, a nice tribute done by Patrick Cassidy in the paper this week.
Okay, and there was one more story I had hoped to get to about a little baby horse who found itself orphaned. That was in Tuesday's paper. People can go to the Cape Cod Times, Cape Cod Online, and check that story out. I want to thank reporter George Brennan of the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online coming in today. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Sean.
You can follow George on Twitter at GPB227. And thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Sally Rose, the Provincetown Banner, Josh Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you all for participating, and I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.